A Forever Girl, a Hamilton Spectator serial podcast. This is part three. I'm John Wells. Whatever happened to Cindy Williams' sister, Michelle? On February 12th, I drove 2.5 hours west of Hamilton to find out. Cindy, taken away on a summer day in 1974, would have turned 46 in January. Michelle, whose married name is Shabbat, is 3 years older. She lives in a little hamlet on Lake Erie, halfway between London and Detroit, beside Rondo Provincial Park. The place is called Erio, a combination of the names Rondo and Erie. In summertime, it is no doubt a bustling and beautiful tourist spot, but when I was there, it was cold and gray, the ground covered in snow. Heading south off the 401, it felt isolated, driving past farmland and then browned cattails to the water's edge, crossing a tiny spit of land that feels vulnerable to being swallowed by the lake. My first impressions of Michelle. She is warm, but does not put on airs. Straight talking, rational in her thinking. And it seemed to me, after a couple hours visiting, she is a strong person. She says that her memory of the time around Cindy's abduction, and even the first couple of years after the remains were discovered, has always been cloudy. As a girl, she no doubt blocked it out as a defense mechanism, shielding herself from pain that no 7-year-old could deal with. She does have a memory, though, of knocking on apartment doors with her mother and her father when they couldn't find Cindy.
You remember going door to door?
That's pretty much the only thing I remember from the day.
It's interesting how that, you know, that so much is blocked out, but you do remember that part of it.
Yeah.
I wonder why. It's interesting, the things that stick in the memory, you know.
Yeah.
Do you remember how you were feeling doing the looking door to door?
I don't think I was too concerned. Right away, but maybe after we had gone to the most probable doors, then I remember, I think by the end of it, I was scared and anxious. Mm-hmm. Like it was, panic starting to set in a bit.
Yeah. And then sort of after that, that's kind of when the wall comes down in terms of, right?
Yeah.
Even after Cindy's skeleton was found, there was still denial. At one point, Michelle wrote a story in grade school for her teacher in which she said Cindy was living in Hawaii.
I really have hardly any memory up until probably till I was 10 or 12 years old.
Yeah.
I blocked out a lot.
I was going to say, probably as a result of this, right? I mean,
there
was a good reason why.
So, I mean, I do. I mean, I remember the day she went missing. I remember the day picking up. I remember the day picking up the newspaper and seeing they'd found a skeleton, and I remember the funeral, but I really don't remember anything else. And the only thing I remember about the funeral is a very small casket.
Everyone has talked about that, white casket.
In the years that followed, her parents watched Michelle's every move, and she in turn was determined not to bring more pain to them.
I mean, I was always a good kid, from my understanding. Even when I was little, I was really good. But I know I had to be good because I wouldn't want to have mom and dad hurt, right?
Because of what had already happened?
Yeah. You know,
you don't want to add to the the burden kind of thing?
So I remember just, you know, trying not to give them any grief or...
Right. Consciously because of Cindy?
Yeah. Well, maybe not because of Cindy, but because I wanted them to be happy.
Yeah.
I didn't want them to have to go through anything.
Right.
She loved her parents, who have both passed away, and never felt anger towards them for letting Cindy roam free in the apartment building. That was what the times were like back then, she says. Michelle has three kids in their 20s. Two daughters and a son. When they were growing up, as a parent, Michelle gravitated more towards letting the kids have freedom than what has been called helicopter parenting. It was, she says, her reaction to being hovered over by her parents which hampered her own growth and confidence, although she was ultimately able to find it in herself as she got older.
I really am a firm believer. You know what? You teach them skills. Mm-hmm. I mean, and don't get me wrong. It's not like I just threw them out the door and forgot about them.
Sure. Yeah.
And I'll tell you, there's a lot of times I did let them go, and I was sick the whole time. Mm-hmm. And then they come home fine, and they looked confident and proud of themselves.
Yeah.
You know.
Interesting. Yeah.
Being a parent, I don't care who you are. And I mean, I'm not saying there's a right and wrong.
Yeah.
I'm just more a proponent leaning towards free range for those reasons.
You don't want to come off as being the know-it-all, but that's the side you lean towards, is that the approach.
When you see, it's great seeing kids feel like they're successful.
Years ago, she took the construction engineering program at Mohawk College and has worked in manufacturing and transportation, in addition to jobs in insurance, as a mortgage broker, retail, even at a bowling alley. She gets bored easily, she jokes. But in Erio, it seems, she's found a place to stay put. For the last 8 years, Michelle and her husband, Joe, have run a seasonal cabin and water sport rental business called Bayside Camp. Joe is also from Hamilton, a salt-of-the-earth type guy, or rather the water. His career has been towing and docking ships in Hamilton Harbor. Their home is about 50 paces from the water's edge in Erio. When the lake is choppy and Michelle is lying in bed at night, the sound of the waves lulls her to sleep. She's a private woman who does not tell others about her sister. Most of her friends in Erio know nothing about it. And she does not let Cindy float into her own mind very often. She keeps those thoughts tucked away in a box, she says, and they mostly only come out when someone asks.
Have you ever wondered what Cindy would look like and who she would be today?
Yep.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What do you see when you think about that?
Well, she'd be strong-willed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think she'd be fun. It's, you know what, it's hard to say too, though, because I'd be a different person too. Mm. You know?
If she was still here. That had never happened.
Well, for sure I would. Yeah. I think I might have ended up the same, but I think it would have been easier getting here.
Michelle has heard that her aunt, Kathy Horbath, helped get the police to reopen Cindy's case. She supports that effort, but over the years has not let herself dwell on who the killer is or if he is still alive. Her wiring does not allow for that kind of thinking. It would have been counterproductive, perhaps even paralyzing, to do so. Kathy, on the other hand, will not let it go. It was her call to the OPP in January that led to an assignment being placed on the desk of Matt Watson, a detective sergeant with their Criminal Investigation Branch, or CIB. The assignment said to look at the Cindy Williams cold case. I met with Matt Watson not long after Kathy did. The first time was in a coffee shop near Toronto, a chance to meet and talk generally about the case with him, but off the record. Like most cops I've met, he is outgoing when chatting off the cuff, but guarded once a notepad and a tape recorder come out. The second time he came to Hamilton, and I recorded our interview while we sat in his vehicle in a parking lot. I had, prior to meeting him, interviewed people connected to Cindy's family. I had even visited her former apartment building at 1165 Fennel Avenue East. I was buzzed inside when I pushed the family's old unit number 402, but when I got to the fourth floor, a woman waiting outside her door, who had thought I was a delivery man from the pharmacy, seeing that I wasn't, shut the door before I could explain why I was there. Anyway, after that bit of amateur sleuthing, it felt good to speak with Detective Watson, although I knew he would be limited in what he could say.
How did the Cindy Williams file cross your desk? How did that come about?
It was assigned to me. We routinely assess old cases. It's not on a set period of time. We don't say every 15 years or every 20 years we'll look at these. But we do periodically go through our old files. We have a look at cases. We see if investigative techniques and things like that have evolved enough that it's worth another look. Certainly, if any new evidence were to come to light, that would push a case like this right to the top. So since 2000, there's been a lot of developments in our investigative techniques. We have the one that most people would be familiar with, obviously, is DNA. But there's other things that we use. We have a lot of different data systems that we use now. The Ontario Sex Offender Registry, for instance, that's available to us now. That wasn't available in the past. There's some other computer programs we use that have improved cooperation, coordination between police services, helped us index and manage our evidence better. The OPP has invested heavily in analytics in the last few years, so that's something that we're bringing to bear on a lot of these investigations now, and that's starting to pay off.
Watson has been with the OPP for 16 years, and prior to that, he was in the Canadian military, which includes serving with the Canadian Airborne Division during operations in Somalia. At 49, he recently married and started a family, and that has colored his view of the Cindy Williams case.
I've got a four-year-old girl myself. I was looking at through this file on the weekend. There's pictures of her in there, and they're heart-wrenching. I mean, I think they'd be heart-wrenching for anybody, but for a parent of a little girl the exact same age, I think there's a personal note there that you you'd have. I think any if you're a human, you're going to feel that, right?
What are the the general or specific challenges with respect to this case in terms of moving it forward in any way, or you know, what are
right now or in the beginning?
Both, right. I guess. Yeah.
Right now, with any cold case, the problem is the passage of time. Witnesses' memories fade. Witnesses die. Witnesses move on, and they're hard to lock down or track down again. Forensic evidence deteriorates, and all of those are going to present challenges. At the time, the challenges they were facing were well, first of all, their investigative techniques and the tools they had at their disposal weren't as evolved as they are now. I've gone through that file. There was certainly no lack of will or lack of determination on the part of the investigators. There was Sergeant Black from Hamilton-Wentworth Regional Police. There was Inspector O'Rourke from the OPP. They put a lot of hours in, and I've gone through all the different leads that they chased up. They chased up leads as far as PEI, Northern Ontario, Calgary. There was a lot of resources that went into this, and there was a lot of dedication from the investigators. But they didn't have the same tools available to them that we do.
Right.
It's as simple as that.
Together with a forensic investigator, Watson has examined the contents of the case evidence box. He won't say specifically what's there. What it likely contains, in addition to all of the reports and interview transcripts from the investigation, are Cindy's clothes found in that field off Glover Road. He said some contents from the box have been sent to the Center of Forensic Sciences in Toronto. He won't say what is being tested or how, but again, common sense says they're testing for DNA to see if they can develop a profile that might lead them to the killer 40 years later. He did confirm that the evidence found in the field in April 1975, where the clothes were separate from the skeleton, suggested there had been a sexual assault. And he shared his thoughts, even though they are preliminary ones, about the murder timeline.
Generally speaking, it is much more common for children who are kidnapped for a sexual purpose who end up being murdered for it to happen within the first hour. That was the impetus behind the Amber Alert system. And that's why we use the Amber Alert system, because we've learned that speed is of the essence in these cases. We need to get the information out there, and we need to find the child immediately.
Results from the CFS testing likely won't come back until late June or even after that. When that happens, he'll make the call about how to proceed, forming an investigative team to interview people of interest, for example. There are suspects who were investigated in 1975 who are still alive. At least one of those suspects is dead. Ed Kuchziak, 21, who lived just a couple of minutes away by car from Cindy's apartment on East 45th Street. He left Hamilton 2 months after Cindy Williams went missing and ended up in Calgary. 11 days after arriving in that city, he was charged with the murder of a 3-year-old girl there. He was sentenced to life, and Hamilton detectives investigated him. But for some reason, he was not pursued further. He died in prison last September. Could a DNA profile from the evidence be matched to him? Watson won't comment about specific suspects. He did say there is value in pursuing the case, even if the killer is dead.
There's no crime in the criminal code that is more serious, both from a legal perspective and just a public concern. I don't want to say public interest perspective, public concern, than the murder of a child. Mm-hmm. And even if a suspect is dead, it's important to bring closure to that. You know, if we can establish that even though this person's dead, that he's the one who did it, I think there's a public benefit to that. A case like that would be the Linda Shaw murder.
Right.
You know, we were able to establish after the offender had died that happened.
Right.
I think most people would agree that's important. Even though we didn't send somebody to prison over it, it was important for us. That was a case that generated tremendous public interest. It scared people. It's good that the public knows that even if we don't convict somebody and send them to prison, that the person who did that, we know who it is, mm-hmm. and they're not a threat to public safety anymore. Mm-hmm. And that's important.
And what about Cindy?
Well, for the family, I mean, that's when I say closure.
Yeah.
I mean, who's more of greater concern than the family mm-hmm. itself?
Right.
It's a platitude, but it's a true one. We speak for the dead. Who else is going to speak for the dead if we don't?
When we finished our interview, we drove out to Glover Road. I showed Matt Watson the place where Cindy's remains had been found. He agreed to stand in the field for a picture. He was hesitant to do so at first, but he knows that things like a newspaper story, a photo, can sometimes encourage people to come forward, maybe inspire someone to talk who knows something. When I started work on the Cindy Williams story, I was not optimistic that the case would be reopened or that anything would come of an investigation if that did happen. After meeting with Matt Watson, I was more optimistic, but still not all that hopeful. DNA is a powerful investigative tool, but what are the chances that A, DNA can be found on the clothes, and B, a DNA profile is developed that could be matched to a person who had motive an opportunity to kill Cindy? Matt Watson was not tipping his hand to me either way about the odds. As for Kathy Horvath, she yearns to bring the killer to justice and says that Cindy's mother, Diane, lived the rest of her life wondering if it had been someone she knew.
Why do you think it's important to put this to rest all these years later?
Probably because I think we've all, you know, when you live through this, you think about it often, especially when you see someone who looks like her. And I just think maybe my sister didn't want to go through the pain of actually finding out it was someone close to her, if that is the case. I know she never looked at anybody the same after. But I think Cindy, whoever did this to Cindy, I really hope that they got what they deserved, or will get what they deserve.
Over the telephone, a former friend of Cindy's parents told me his theory on the murder. It was, he always believed, payback against Cindy's adoptive father, John Trewadi, who had shady dealings in Hamilton for years. I put that theory to Jim Van Allen, a behavioral analyst who managed the OPP's criminal profiling unit for 15 years. Van Allen said that doesn't make any sense. Street criminals, or mafia types, don't abduct, rape, and kill children. No, he said, this is a sex crime committed by a deviant personality, but likely not an experienced pedophile who would typically have polished, manipulative skills. That is, the pedophile doesn't abduct because he doesn't need to. What can happen is a child killer abducts because he lacks those skills, and then after fulfilling his sexual urges and facing the reality of what he has done, and the fear and pain a child would exhibit, he loses it, panics, and then murders, and tries to cover up what he has done. It is also often the case, but not always, that sexual violence done to a child is committed by those who know the child or know the family. Kathy Horvath knows the implications of that when it comes to reopening the case.
Has this, reopening this, it's a Pandora's box in a sense. Has that affected you in terms of you thinking about people that are alive or dead still that knew Diane and that you know and wondering about people?
Yeah, because as you know, there's some people that I would hate to find out that I knew them and they had done this. Because, you know, we've always been, our whole family's always been, you know, we take people at face value, and I mean, we've all made judgment errors in how people are, and they turn out to be someone who you didn't think they were. Hopefully it's somebody we didn't know well, because I think that would be horrible.
Is there anyone alive today who you still are in touch with on occasion, who you think should be answering some questions about this? And if so, have you shared your feelings with any of those people?
Yes and no. Yes, there are some people that I really would like to talk to. But no, I haven't actually gone that far, and I haven't told them what I thought.
On Wednesday afternoon, March 30th, I met Kathy, along with Diane's childhood friend, Cynthia Wilson Shepherd, in Woodland Cemetery, so they could show me Cindy's grave. Cynthia comes to the plot every couple of weeks. She says that Diane, who died in 2005 from cancer, made a vow to her on her deathbed.
She told me when she was dying, I don't know if she told you, but she told me when she was dying, I will send you a message when I find out who did this.
Oh, like in death?
Yeah.
She swore, I'm going to send you a message. She's never sent me a message, and I never dream about Diane.
You don't? Yeah.
Never.
Really?
Never.
Do you believe in that notion that she could send you a message?
I think she will eventually.
Yeah.
I really do. Mm-hmm. But I think that's why I don't dream about her, because maybe she doesn't know yet. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Why don't I dream about her? Maybe if I dream about her, then I'll get the message.
We drove in the cemetery to the children's section, Section 6, where stories are told on gravestones of lives barely lived, boys and girls forever young. Cindy's small stone features an angel praying, and it reads, "In loving memory of Cindy Williams, January 20, 1970 to July 26, 1974, always remembered." While Kathy and Cynthia stood over the stone and a spectator photographer took pictures, I walked away and turned on my recorder.
It's a nice setting on the water. And the sun has come out, first time today, really, that the sun has broken free, and now it suddenly feels warm on the spot. And despite myself, I feel emotional standing here. I'm not sure why. I mean, I know why, but I don't know why. It's I was 6 years old or so at the time myself.
We talked a bit more, and then I said goodbye to Kathy and Cynthia and drove home. I listened to the engine hum for a while, then put on some music, loud. I began this serial podcast explaining how, years ago, a Hamilton police officer named Paul LaHaye first told me about the Cindy Williams cold case. I emailed LaHaye recently to let him know that I was now writing a story. He is nearing retirement and no longer in homicide investigation. He wrote me back, pleased to hear I was working on the piece, adding that he hoped it would get her case back in the news and maybe get questions answered. His passion for the case, I learned, had not waned all these years later. He wrote to me, quote, "I wanted to get the story out about Cindy when we met, John, because I was personally shocked that she was able to slip away from the conscience of people. When I was younger and on my day off, I used to jog along Glover Road purposely to think about and remember Cindy. It was my private tribute to let her know I hadn't forgotten her name. I remember the beautiful little girl who was taken away, unquote. He added that he believes for victims like her, it's up to police, the public, and journalists to carry the torch. I read that email a few times. Torch. I thought about calling the story that. You can't change the past, and often can't find clean justice, or even the more ambiguous sense of closure. But you can walk that road, even if it's an unpleasant one. You can carry that torch. We can remember. This has been The Forever Girl, a Hamilton Spectator serial podcast. I'm John Wells. Thanks for listening.